So, how do you know a thermometer is accurate? I
Right.
mean, if you are listening to this right now, I want you to like really think about that for a second.
It sounds so simple at first.
Exactly. You probably have a digital one in your medicine cabinet, right? Or maybe an old glass one just knocking around in a drawer somewhere.
Yeah, the classic mercury ones.
Right. And when you feel sick, you put it under your tongue. It beeps. It says 98.6 degrees, and you just completely trust it.
You don't even question it.
Never. But if I really push you on it, if I ask you how you know that little plastic stick is actually telling you the truth about the physical universe, you might, I don't know, reach back into your memory of high school science class.
You'd probably say something about calibration.
Yeah, exactly. You'd say, well, somebody calibrated it at a factory. You use the freezing point of water for 0 degrees Celsius and the boiling point of water for 100 degrees Celsius.
Right.
And then you just set your scale between those two fixed, undeniable points.
Which sounds perfectly logical.
It does. It sounds like solid bedrock science.
But the problem arises when you take one more step back, you know, when you ask the obvious yet incredibly dangerous follow-up question.
Which is, how do you actually know that water always boils at that exact same fixed temperature?
Right, because you'd have to measure it to be sure.
You would. You'd have to measure it. And what tool are you going to use to measure the boiling point of water across 100 different experiments?
You have to use the thermometer.
But wait, how do you know that master thermometer is accurate?
Because it was calibrated using the boiling point of water.
Exactly. And you are suddenly caught in this completely wild feedback loop.
You really are. I mean, you need the measured phenomenon of the boiling water to validate the instrument,
Yeah.
but you absolutely require the instrument to validate the phenomenon.
It's crazy.
It is. Without the thermometer, you just can't prove the water is behaving consistently. And without the consistent water, well, you can't build the thermometer.
When you really sit with that, it feels like the floor just drops out from under you.
Completely.
It's a circular trap. We base our understanding of temperature on this supposedly objective standard, but the standard is just justifying itself.
Right.
And this isn't just some, fun little dorm room philosophy brain teaser. This was a real historical crisis that paralyzed scientists for decades.
It really was a massive hurdle.
And that is exactly where we are starting today's deep dive. We are looking at a brilliantly mind-bending paper from 2026 by C.F. Dietz.
Titled, The Grammar of Iteration.
Right, the grammar of iteration. And Dietz's paper explores the work of Hasak Chang, who is this renowned professor of history and philosophy of science at the University of Cambridge.
He wrote a fantastic book on this exact subject called Inventing Temperature.
Yeah. So Chang's historical work, which Dietz synthesizes into this broader philosophical framework, forces us to confront this exact circularity.
Because the story of the thermometer is actually a perfect microcosm for the story of all human knowledge.
That's the crazy part. So our mission today, the reason we're doing this deep dive, is to explore how human knowledge and how science itself actually improves.
Right.
Because the spoiler alert here is that it does not improve by starting from absolute, undeniable certainty.
Not at all.
It improves by bootstrapping its way up from imperfect, flawed, totally compromised starting points. We are going to look at how we build these incredibly precise scientific realities out of basically initially bad guesses.
Which runs completely counter to the traditional popular view of science. You know,
100%.
culturally, we tend to view science as this pristine edifice built on a rock-solid foundation.
Like math, almost.
Exactly. We imagine that somewhere at the very bottom of the scientific method, beneath all the theories and equations, there's a bedrock of pure, objective, undeniable truth.
Right.
And we assume every new discovery is just another brick laid perfectly on top of that foundation.
But Chang's work, especially when it intersects with what Beetz calls the closure framework, argues that this foundation is just a total myth.
It is a myth.
The foundation is always provisional. It is always a little bit broken. And yet the progress we make is undeniably real.
It's fascinating.
I really want to dig into that because to understand this concept, we have to go right back to the trenches of that circular thermometer problem.
Let's do it.
Let's put ourselves in the shoes of the early thermoscopists in the 17th century.
So we are talking about people like Galileo or the scientists at the Florentine Academy.
Right, those guys. Imagine being in their position for a second. You are trying to figure out how to quantify heat.
Which is a concept that is entirely subjective up to this point in history.
Completely subjective. You feel hot, you feel cold. That is literally all you have.
Right.
So you invent these primitive instruments called thermoscopes, and they were often just glass tubes with a bulb at the top, placed upside down in a basin of water.
Very simple setups.
Yeah. When the air inside the bulb got warm, it expanded and pushed the water level down. And when it cooled, it contracted and the water level rose.
So you could visually see a reaction to heat.
You can see it. But here's the catch. You have absolutely zero way to verify their accuracy.
None.
You can't just run to a modern laboratory and check your glass tube against a digital sensor. You are trying to create the very concept of a standardized temperature scale from literal scratch.
And you quickly run into terrifying variables.
Oh, man, the variables.
For instance, those early open-air thermoscopes weren't just reacting to temperature. They were reacting to atmospheric pressure.
Right.
But those scientists didn't fully understand atmospheric pressure yet. So a storm would roll in, the pressure would drop, the water level in the tube would change, and the scientists would think the room had suddenly gotten hotter or colder.
Even though it felt exactly the same to their own skin.
Exactly. It must have been completely maddening.
It's like you are trying to build the world's first ruler. Think about it. How do you mark an inch on a blank piece of wood if you don't already have something that measures an inch?
You can't.
You can't. You have no reference point. And Chang points out that this is a profound philosophical problem. It's the lack of what is called an Archimedean point.
Right, the Archimedean point.
Can you break that down for us?
Sure. So the term comes from the ancient Greek mathematician Archimedes.
Right.
He famously claimed that if he had a long enough lever and a solid point to stand on outside the Earth, he could move the planet.
Give me a place to stand and I will move the Earth.
Exactly. So in philosophy, an Archimedean point represents this mythical, objective vantage point entirely outside the universe.
Like a God's eye view.
Exactly. It's a theoretical place where you can stand completely free of any human biases, sensor limitations, or flawed instruments, and just look at the raw, unfiltered truth of reality.
All right.
If you had that point, you could easily verify your scientific systems. You could just check your thermometer against the absolute truth of the universe.
But Chang and Dietz are pointing out the hard truth here. We don't have that point.
We absolutely do not.
We are stuck inside the universe. Any human being, any scientific community, any laboratory can only draw distinctions from inside its own organizational structure.
We are inside the fishbowl trying to measure the water using tools made of water.
That's a great way to put it. We are inside the fishbowl.
Therefore, the demand for an Archimedean point is just a philosophical trap. The anxiety that we are just playing a massive game of make-believe that all stems from the belief that without this perfect outside perspective, our knowledge is somehow invalid.
Okay, but I have to admit, that anxiety feels pretty justified.
It does feel that way.
I mean, if there is no Archimedean point, doesn't this mean that all of science is just built on a vicious, inescapable circle of guessing?
Right. That's the fear.
If my only way to check a thermometer is with boiling water and my only way to check the water is with the thermometer, I'm just spinning in circles forever.
Well, Chang calmly reframes this entire dilemma. He doesn't deny it. He acknowledges the circularity. You cannot escape the reality of using an assumption to build a tool to verify the very same assumption.
Right.
However, he introduces a vital distinction. It is a circle, yes, but it is not a vicious circle.
Not a vicious circle.
Right. It is what we might call a virtuous circle or a bootstrapping process.
Bootstrapping. Okay, so how does spinning in a circle become virtuous? Like, how does that actually work?
By letting go of the obsession with a perfect starting point. The history of thermometry shows us that we do not need a flawless foundation.
We don't.
No. All we actually need is a starting point that allows us to act.
Just to do something.
Exactly. We need a provisional standard that permits us to begin making inquiries, no matter how flawed that standard might be.
So you just pick something. You say, look, I don't know for absolute universal certainty that water always boils at the exact same temperature everywhere in the cosmos, but I need to start somewhere.
Right. Let's just assume for a second that it does, and let's build our glass tube based on that guess.
You start from exactly where you stand.
Exactly. You take your uncertain, compromised standard and you put it to work. Because a flawed standard is infinitely more useful than complete paralysis.
Yeah, if you wait for perfection, you'll never build a thermometer.
Exactly. The flawed standard allows you to step out of the armchair, go into the laboratory, and actually interact with the physical world.
Okay, I follow the logic of needing to start somewhere. I think everyone can relate to that. But here is where my mind gets stuck and where I imagine anyone listening would naturally want to push back.
Go ahead.
If we start with a flawed ruler or a flawed thermometer, if our foundation is just a semi-educated guess, how do we ever achieve the mind-bending precision of modern science?
Right.
Because we are landing rovers on specific craters on Mars. We are manipulating individual atoms in quantum computers.
The precision is incredible.
It is. You cannot achieve that level of precision on a foundation of just guessing. How does a bad starting point actually transform into a reliable truth?
The mechanism of that transformation is really the beating heart of Chang's philosophy. It is a concept he calls epistemic iteration.
Epistemic iteration. Okay, let's break that down. Epistemic meaning relating to knowledge.
Right.
And iteration meaning doing something over and over, refining it each time.
Exactly. Epistemic iteration is the process by which successive stages of knowledge build upon preceding ones, specifically to enhance our overarching goals of understanding.
Okay, so building on the past.
Right. Let's return to those historical scientists. You started with that flawed thermoscope. You made a guess about the boiling point of water. You built the tube. You marked the glass.
Right.
Now, you actually use it. You take it out into the world, and you start measuring things obsessively. And because your instrument is flawed and your assumption was imperfect, you inevitably start discovering anomalies.
Right, because the world doesn't perfectly fit your neat little guess.
It never does.
You take your thermometer up a mountain, and suddenly the water boils at a completely different mark on the glass.
Exactly. You discover that atmospheric pressure dramatically alters the boiling point.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Or you try using different liquids inside the tube to see if they work better. You swap out water for alcohol or linseed oil or mercury.
Right.
And you realize that different liquids have entirely different thermal expansion profiles. They don't expand at the same uniform rate as they heat up.
Okay, so this is where Dietz's paper becomes so incredibly useful, because Dietz integrates Chang's historical deep dive into this broader theoretical model he calls the closure framework.
Yes.
Dietz translates these historical anomalies into two very specific, powerful terms, supersession and remainder.
The closure framework gives us a really precise vocabulary for what is happening during epistemic iteration.
Right.
In Dietz's terminology, your current scientific paradigm, your flawed thermometer, your assumptions about boiling points, the laboratory setup you are using that entire package is a closure.
A closure.
Yes. It is a finite, closed system of organized knowledge and practice.
So it's like the conceptual bubble we have constructed to make sense of things.
That's a good way to look at it. But because every closure is finite, and the real physical universe is infinitely complex, the closure can never capture everything.
Of course not.
Therefore, every closure inevitably generates what Dietz calls remainder.
Remainder. Like when you do long division and the numbers don't divide perfectly, you have a little bit left over that doesn't fit into the whole numbers.
Exactly like that. The remainder consists of all the phenomena that your current framework simply cannot absorb, explain, or predict.
I see.
When you take the thermometer up the mountain and the boiling point changes, that pressure effect is the remainder. When the alcohol expands differently than the mercury, that discrepancy is the remainder.
I am trying to visualize this. It's almost like, imagine you build a wooden box to hold a bunch of odd-shaped rocks.
Okay.
You pack them in as best you can and nail the lid shut. The box is your closure.
Right.
But there are a few jagged rocks sticking out, preventing the lid from closing all the way.
Yeah.
Those jagged edges, the parts that absolutely refuse to fit into your neat little box, that is the remainder.
That captures the friction perfectly. And this concept of remainder gives us a radically different way to view how scientific progress actually happens.
How so?
Well, to appreciate how unique Chang and Dietz's perspective is, we should contrast it with the most famous philosophies of science from the 20th century. Consider Karl Popper, for example.
Right. Karl Popper, if anyone listening took a philosophy class, they probably heard his name. He is the falsification guy.
Exactly.
He argued that science works by scientists making these massive, bold conjectures about how the universe works, and then they spent all their time trying to destroy their own theories with crucial experiments.
Popper's classic example is the statement, all swans are white.
Right.
You can never prove that statement true, because you can't check every swan in the universe.
Obviously not.
But you only need to find one black swan to prove it false.
Just one.
So in Popper's view, science doesn't prove things true. It aggressively falsifies things. If an experiment proves a theory wrong, the theory is executed. You throw it out and start over with a new bold conjecture.
It is a very dramatic, almost violent view of progress.
Very dramatic.
And then on the other side, you have Thomas Kuhn, who wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions.
Right, paradigm shifts.
Yeah. Kuhn argued that science actually goes through long, relatively boring periods of normal science, where everyone basically agrees on the rules.
Right.
But eventually, anomalies build up until the system just breaks, leading to a massive, chaotic paradigm shift.
Kuhn's paradigm shift is like realizing you are playing the wrong game entirely.
Yeah.
You realize the Earth isn't the center of the universe, the sun is, so you flip the entire board over, throw out the old rules, and start a completely new game.
But Dietz is pointing out that Chang's concept of epistemic iteration is neither of those extremes.
Not at all.
It's not Popper's sudden execution of a theory, and it's not Kuhn's chaotic flipping of the board.
Epistemic iteration is much slower. It's highly persistent and strictly cumulative.
Cumulative.
Yes. In this model, the remainder, the anomalies that Popper might use to execute a theory doesn't destroy the system. It drives revision.
Okay.
And that revision produces a slightly better closure. You don't throw the thermometer in the trash because it failed to account for atmospheric pressure on a mountain.
Right. You don't just give up.
No, you say the remainder is telling me something crucial about the environment. You take that remainder and you use it to revise your starting point. You build a new, more sophisticated thermometer that physically controls for pressure.
So the closure generates remainder. The remainder forces the closure to supersede itself, to upgrade, basically. And that new upgraded closure generates new, more subtle remainder.
Exactly. Each iteration is less imperfect than the last. You pull yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Okay, I love the elegance of that mechanism. It feels very organic. But I have to play devil's advocate here because there is a glaring issue for me.
Let's hear it.
If the starting point is bad, if my first thermometer is just genuinely a terrible, deeply flawed guess, isn't the remainder just going to be random noise?
Walk me through your thinking there. Why would it be random noise?
Well, because if my tool is completely broken, the data it gives me is broken.
Right.
If I try to build a ruler out of elastic rubber, the measurements I get aren't going to teach me how to make a better wooden ruler. They're just going to be random, stretchy garbage.
Okay, I see.
If my first thermoscope is just a tube of water reacting to a dozen unknown variables, how does the resulting chaos tell us how to fix the instrument? How does noise become a blueprint?
That is perhaps the most important question you can ask to test this theory. And it gets to the absolute crux of Dietz's synthesis of Chang.
Okay.
The answer is this. Remainder is almost never random noise.
It's not.
No. Even when generated by a heavily flawed closure, remainder is highly specific.
Specific.
Yes. It is the exact, precise signature of how your current conceptual framework is diverging from the physical reality it is trying to measure.
I'm going to need an analogy for that, because how can a failure be a precise signature? That's hard to wrap my head around.
Let me offer one. Have you ever tried to make a copy of a physical key when you don't have the original?
Like with clay or something.
Exactly. Imagine you are trying to cast a mold of a complex keyhole, but the clay you're using is a bit too soft, and you don't really know the shape of the lock inside.
Right.
You shove the clay in, pull it out, and the resulting shape is warped and messy. It doesn't open the door.
Right. It's a failed key.
It is a failure, yes. Mm. But the ways in which it is warped, the specific dents, scratches, and compressed areas on the clay aren't just random damage.
Oh.
They are the exact negative shape of the internal lock mechanism that you didn't account for. The failure itself contains the precise dimensions of your ignorance.
Oh, wow. Okay. The remainder is the negative space of the reality you are missing.
Exactly. Dietz states this explicitly in his paper. The remainder is the empirical proof that your grammar, your current closure, is finite.
Right.
But because the remainder is highly specific, it dictates the exact direction that revision must take. Going back to the thermoscopes, when they failed, they didn't just output meaningless static.
Right, it wasn't just random water levels.
No, the variations in the boiling point perfectly tracked the changes in atmospheric pressure. The failure was a map pointing directly to the concept of pressure.
So you don't just guess again randomly.
No.
You don't throw away the soft clay key and just whittle a piece of wood blindfolded. You revise directly in response to the specific pressure marks left on the clay.
Exactly.
That is why epistemic iteration is cumulative, not just trial and error. Trial and error starts fresh every time. Iteration carries the lessons of the failure forward.
Precisely. The specific ways the early instruments failed contained the exact information scientists needed to figure out what to control for next. They learned to seal the tubes. They learned to standardize the liquid.
So progress isn't about leaping towards some perfect glowing truth in the sky.
Not at all.
It's about looking down at the dirt, looking closely at our broken tools, and making them work just a little bit better based on exactly how they broke yesterday.
The foundation is never certain. The goal is not to reach a flawless foundation, but to keep iterating toward a more capable system from wherever we currently stand.
I am fully on board with the mechanics of this. It makes so much sense. But this raises a massive philosophical red flag for me.
Okay, let's explore it.
And I think for you listening, this might be the moment where you say, hold on a second, we skipped a step.
Right.
If we aren't measuring our progress against absolute truth with a capital T, if we explicitly do not have that Archimedean point to check our work against, what are we measuring it against?
It's a great question.
How do we even define what better means if we don't know what perfect looks like?
To answer that, we really had to follow Chang into his next major conceptual shift.
Okay.
We have to fundamentally change what we think science is. We have to stop looking at science as just a collection of beliefs or propositions.
Like a list of facts you memorize in a textbook.
Exactly. And we need to start viewing it as what Chang calls systems of practice.
Systems of practice? What does that mean in a tangible, real-world sense?
It means science is an integrated set of human activities. Yes. It is not just the abstract theory written on the chalkboard. It encompasses the physical methods, the design of the experiments, the literal standards of measurement, the social ways evidence is evaluated by peers.
So the whole process.
Right. A system of practice includes everything a scientific community does to generate knowledge.
Okay, so it's the entire living ecosystem of the laboratory, the funding, the peer review, the instruments, not just the final published paper.
Yes. And this shift from viewing science as a list of propositions to viewing it as an active system of practices is philosophically massive.
Why is it so massive?
Because if science is an active system, then the way we define truth has to change. Chang proposes replacing our traditional rigid idea of truth with the pragmatic concept he calls operational coherence.
Operational coherence. All right, let's contrast those two. What is the traditional idea of truth that he is trying to replace?
The traditional idea is known in philosophy as correspondence truth.
Correspondence truth.
Right. This is the highly intuitive idea that a scientific theory is true if it perfectly mirrors or corresponds to a mind-independent reality.
Okay.
It's the idea that there is a definitive way the universe is, entirely separate from human observers, and our theories are like photographs. If the photograph perfectly matches the external reality, it is true.
Which sounds completely reasonable. It's what we all instinctively believe from childhood. A map is true if it corresponds perfectly to the territory.
It sounds reasonable until you remember the Archimedean point.
Ah, right. We can't stand outside the universe.
Exactly. How do you check if your mental photograph perfectly matches a reality that you can only ever look at through that very same photograph?
You can't.
You cannot step outside your own brain, outside your own sensory apparatus, to compare your mental model of the universe against the real universe. You only have access to your models.
Right. It's like trying to check if your sunglasses are tinting the world red by looking through the sunglasses.
That's a perfect analogy.
You can't do it. So correspondence truth is basically an impossible standard because we can never actually perform the comparison.
Therefore, Chang argues we should discard correspondence truth as the ultimate goal of science.
Just throw it out.
Basically, yes. Instead, a system is considered successful or functionally true when it achieves operational coherence.
Operational coherence.
This means its various components function together harmoniously without breaking down.
Okay, let me try an analogy here to see if I am grasping the shift. It's like evaluating a well-tuned engine in a car.
Okay, let's hear it.
When a mechanic builds a car engine, they don't stand back, look at the metal, and ask, is this engine true? Does this physical engine perfectly correspond to the eternal, mind-independent form of an engine floating out in the cosmos?
Right, that would be an absurd question.
It would be totally meaningless. The mechanic asks, does it work?
Exactly.
They ask if the spark plugs fire at the exact right millisecond to ignite the fuel, which drives the piston smoothly, which turns the crankshaft, which moves the wheels. If all those moving parts function together smoothly without tearing the engine apart or stalling, the engine is operationally coherent. It drives the car forward.
That is a superb translation of operational coherence.
Okay.
In a scientific system of practice, the moving parts are the concepts, the predictions, the physical measurements, and the mathematical standards.
Okay.
If your theoretical concept of temperature matches the physical operations you use to measure it with a glass tube,
right,
and if your mathematical predictions are consistently confirmed by those physical measurements, and if your standards of evidence hold up without producing internal contradictions, your system is operationally coherent. The engine is running smoothly.
And Dietz maps this directly onto his closure framework, correct?
He does, and he uses some pretty heavy systems theory to do it.
Oh, boy.
In Dietz's vocabulary, operational coherence is what a closure achieves when it successfully constitutes its facts.
Constitutes its facts.
Right. To explain how a framework maintains this coherence, Dietz references the concept of autopoiesis, originally developed by biologists Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, as well as Stuart Kaufman's idea of constraint closure.
I have to admit, I am completely lost on the biology connection.
It's a leap, I know.
Autopoiesis, that's the theory of how biological cells maintain themselves, right?
Yes, exactly.
How on earth is a scientific theory like a biological cell? That feels like a huge stretch.
Well, think about what a biological cell actually does. Maturana and Varela defined autopoiesis as a network of chemical reactions that continually produces the very components that make up the network.
Okay.
The cell wall contains the chemical reactions. The chemical reactions build the cell wall. It is a closed loop that maintains its own boundaries and internal logic against the chaotic environment outside.
Okay, so the cell builds itself to protect itself.
Now apply that to a scientific closure. A system of practice creates a network of concepts and instruments that mutually support each other.
Oh, I see where this is going.
The theory of thermodynamics dictates how you build the thermometer. The thermometer produces data that confirms the theory of thermodynamics.
Wow.
The scientific framework maintains its own internal logic and continues to operate smoothly despite the confusing pressures of the raw physical universe. It is a conceptually autopoietic system.
That is fascinating. The science sustains its own reality.
It does.
Which brings us to one of the most mind-bending parts of the source material. Dietz brings up a specific, highly controversial example to prove how powerful this idea of a constituted fact inside a closure really is.
The Metzinger example.
Yes. He dives into the work of a philosopher named Thomas Metzinger and his famous no-self conclusion. Let's really unpack this, because when I read this section, it completely shifted how I view reality.
It's a powerful argument.
Yeah.
So Thomas Metzinger is a prominent philosopher of mind.
Right.
He is famous for arguing that the self, that distinct feeling of being you sitting inside your head, looking out through your eyes, is an illusion.
An illusion.
Yes. He relies heavily on modern neuroscience to make this claim. He points out that neurobiology shows us the brain constantly constructs the feeling of a cohesive self out of millions of disparate, decentralized neural processes.
Right. There is no center of the brain where the you actually lives.
Exactly. Because it is a construct. Because it is assembled behind the scenes by the brain's internal systems. Metzinger concludes it is not real in the absolute mind-independent sense.
Okay.
Therefore, he says, the self is essentially a hallucination. It doesn't actually exist out there in the universe.
But Dietz and Chang look at that exact same neuroscience. They agree that the self is constructed by the brain, but they come to the exact opposite philosophical conclusion.
They do.
They argue that Metzinger has fallen headfirst into the trap of correspondence truth.
Exactly right.
Metzinger assumes that for something to be a genuine fact, it has to exist entirely independently of any system observing or constructing it.
Dietz forcefully argues that Metzinger is confusing constituted facts with fake facts.
Fake facts.
Right. According to the closure framework, constituted facts are genuine facts. In fact, for human beings, they're the only kind of facts we can ever possibly access.
Dietz gives these brilliant examples to make this concrete. Think about the color red.
Perfect example.
An apple is red as constituted by our human visual system. The concept of redness doesn't exist out in the dark void of the universe.
Right. Objects just reflect electromagnetic wavelengths.
Exactly. Red is a fact entirely created by the closure of human biology interacting with that light. But that doesn't mean the color red is a fake hallucination.
Not at all.
It is a real operationally coherent fact within our biological system of practice. If you ignore a red stoplight, you will get into a very real car crash.
Building on that, the fact that water is 100 degrees Celsius is a real fact as constituted by the system of thermometry.
Right.
And the self, the feeling of being you, is a real fact as constituted by the brain's organizational closure. You do not dismiss the self as an illusion just because it is constructed by neurons, any more than you dismiss temperature as an illusion just because we had to construct glass thermometers to measure it.
They aren't fake facts. They are operationally coherent facts. They are the engine of reality running smoothly for us.
This represents a profound philosophical rehabilitation. We do not have to despair that our scientific knowledge, or even our sense of self, is just a construct.
Right.
Being a construct that achieves operational coherence is the highest standard of truth available to any finite being in the universe.
I'm completely with you on the beauty and the relief of that perspective. It feels good. But again, I have to push back on behalf of the listener, because this feels like it could easily slip into very dangerous territory.
How so?
If truth is just whatever works smoothly inside our chosen system, isn't that just a self-contained game? Let me use another analogy. Think about the game of Monopoly.
Okay, Monopoly.
In Monopoly, it is an operationally coherent fact that Pass and Go collects you $200.
Right.
The rules are internally consistent. The game functions smoothly. But the Monopoly money has absolutely nothing to do with the actual physical universe.
Obviously.
If science is just about operational coherence, how does it not just become an elaborate multi-billion-dollar game of Monopoly? Where does the real world come into play?
That is the exact trap of pure pragmatism or radical relativism, where truth becomes nothing more than whatever a specific community agrees on.
Right. If everyone agrees Monopoly money is real, then it's real.
Exactly. But Chang explicitly designs his philosophy to avoid this trap. And this is where we introduce a crucial stabilizing concept, activist realism.
Activist realism. Okay, how does this keep us grounded?
So Chang rejects correspondence realism, the idea that we map perfectly onto an independent reality.
Right.
But he is vehemently not an anti-realist. He does not believe science is just a self-contained game.
Yeah.
He introduces activist realism not as a biological fact, but as a stance.
A stance.
Yes. It is a conscious commitment to do absolutely everything we can to improve our knowledge by treating reality not as a fixed structure we must perfectly mimic, but as an active partner that we continually learn from.
Learn from. Okay. How does that active partnership differentiate science from the Monopoly game?
Well, think about your Monopoly analogy. The game of Monopoly does not push back against you.
No, it doesn't.
The cardboard, board, and the plastic pieces do not suddenly generate physical anomalies that force you to invent new rules.
Mm-hmm.
If you pass Go, you get $200 every single time until the end of time.
Right. It's totally static.
But the physical universe is not a cardboard board. Reality pushes back. Reality is what generates the remainder.
The remainder returns to save the day.
Yes. You set up your operationally coherent system, your scientific closure, you build your particle accelerator or your climate model or your thermometer. It runs smoothly for a while. But because you are actively engaging with the messy, infinite physical universe, eventually your predictions will fail. Your measurements will get weird. The physical universe actively pushes back against the artificial boundaries of your closure, and it generates remainder.
So reality isn't the perfect static photograph we are trying to match. Reality is the wild thing that keeps breaking our beautifully tuned engines.
Ditz maps this relentless pushback onto a profound concept in his framework called M.
Just the letter M.
Yes, M. It stands for the inexhaustible ground.
The inexhaustible ground.
It represents the underlying infinite reality that every single closure opens onto, but can never, ever fully capture or contain.
Wow.
M is by definition infinitely complex. Our human closures, our brains, our theories are strictly finite. Therefore, whenever our finite closure interacts with M, M will inevitably overflow the boundaries of the closure.
It spills over.
Exactly. That overflow, that chaotic spillover, is the remainder.
So taking the stance of activist realism is the constant acknowledgement of M. It's a scientist saying, I know my closure is finite. I know my model is a simplification. I know M is inexhaustible. Therefore, I fully expect to encounter remainder. I am waiting for the engine to break.
And crucially, activist realism dictates exactly how you must react when the engine inevitably breaks. This is why Dietz and Chang describe it not just as a scientific method, but as a practical and ethical stance.
I noticed that word in the source material, and it really struck me. An ethical commitment to data.
Yes.
It's about having the humility to not aggressively defend your current worldview when it starts generating remainder.
Which is hard.
It's so hard because human nature, whether you are a 17th century chemist or a modern person just scrolling social media when our internal engine breaks or our worldview is challenged by facts that don't neatly fit, our first instinct is to get deeply defensive.
We want to hide the contradictory data. We want to say, no, the thermometer is perfectly fine. The universe is just acting weird today.
Yeah.
We build walls to protect our fragile closure from the pressure of the remainder.
Which, if you are a scientist, is the absolute death of progress.
It is.
The activist realist has to train themselves to do the exact opposite. They take what presses back seriously. Instead of defending the current constitution against the pressure of what it cannot absorb, they gather up all that uncomfortable remainder and use it as the raw material for the next iteration.
Exactly.
They treat the failure as their most valuable resource.
I love the analogy you used earlier about martial arts. It perfectly applies here.
Right, the martial arts thing. If someone throws a punch at you, you don't stand completely rigid and try to block it with brute force. The impact will just break your arm.
Right.
You take the energy of the punch, you absorb the momentum, and you use it to pivot into a better position.
You use the physical pressure of reality to drive your next super session.
I want to connect this deeply to you, the listener, right now, because this philosophy isn't just about 18th century laboratory equipment.
No, it's very personal.
This is fundamentally about the psychology of learning and human growth. Think about a time in your life when you encountered something that just shattered your worldview.
We've all had them.
Maybe it was a personal relationship that didn't make sense anymore, or a deeply held political belief that was contradicted by reality, or an assumption about how your career industry works.
Right.
When that happens, when your internal mental closure fails and generates a massive amount of remainder, which usually manifests as confusion, cognitive dissonance, or pain, you have a distinct choice.
You always have a choice. The instinct is to double down. You can build thicker walls around your broken closure and refuse to look at the remainder.
Which so many people do.
They do. You can become dogmatic, rigid, and ultimately stagnant.
Or you can adopt activist realism in your own life. You can say, this pain, this confusion, this failure of my mental model, this isn't just random noise.
Right.
This is specific feedback from M, from the inexhaustible ground of reality. It is a precise signature telling me exactly how my previous understanding was too small.
You allow the remainder to break your old model.
Exactly. So it can force a supersession to a better, more complex understanding.
Which leads us directly to the final, and perhaps most liberating, implication of this entire philosophical framework.
Let's hear it.
If reality M is truly inexhaustible, and if our human closures are always structurally finite, then that must mean that no single scientific theory, no matter how advanced, and no single human perspective will ever be able to explain absolutely everything perfectly.
Right, because any finite net you cast into an infinite ocean is going to let water slip through.
Exactly.
Every closure generates remainder, always. There is no final theory of everything.
So this raises a really fascinating dilemma.
What's that?
What happens when two completely different scientific theories or two completely different systems of practice clash over the exact same subject matter?
Oh, man.
Do we have to declare one the absolute objective truth and the other a complete delusional lie?
This brings us to a concept called scientific pluralism. The idea of having many different lenses, but one underlying reality.
Because every finite closure generates its own highly specific remainder, Chang argues strongly for scientific pluralism. This is the view that multiple, seemingly contradictory systems of practice can actually provide valid, complementary knowledge about the exact same domain.
I want to ground this in the specific historical example from Dietz's text because it completely rewired how I think about the history of science.
The chemistry example.
Yeah, let's talk about the clash between phlogiston theory and oxygen theory in the history of chemistry. Now, if you are like me, you probably learned in middle school that phlogiston was just a dumb, fake idea that primitive scientists made up, and oxygen was the shining truth that finally rode in on a white horse to defeat it.
That is the standard, simplified narrative we teach children, yes.
We're great.
But Chang's deep historical work shows the reality was vastly more complex and much more interesting. Let's look at it strictly through the lens of closures and remainder. Phlogiston theory, which was developed in the late 17th century by chemists like Georg Ernst Stahl, was an incredibly successful, operationally coherent system for a long time.
It wasn't just a random guess. It solved real problems.
It did. It posited that combustible materials contained a fire-like substance called phlogiston. When you burned wood, the wood released its phlogiston into the air, and what was left behind was dephlogisticated ash.
Okay.
It explained why a candle goes out. If you put it in a sealed jar, the air in the jar becomes fully saturated with phlogiston and just can't absorb anymore.
Wow, that actually makes perfect sense.
It allowed scientists to manipulate metals and acids in highly productive ways.
It was an engine that drove the car of chemistry forward for decades.
It was. But as with all finite closures interacting with an infinite M, it generated remainder.
Of course.
Specifically, a massive anomaly arose when chemists studied the calcination of metals.
What is calcination?
When you burn certain metals, like tin or lead, they turn into a powdery calx. According to phlogiston theory, they should be losing phlogiston, which means they should weigh less.
Right. If they're losing something, they get lighter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But experiments showed the calx actually weighed more than the original metal.
Which makes zero sense if burning means losing a substance. That weight gain was remainder.
It was the physical reality of M aggressively pushing back against the phlogiston closure.
I read that some chemists tried to defend the closure by arguing that phlogiston had negative weight.
Yes.
Which sounds exactly like building a wall to protect a failing model.
It is the textbook definition of defending a fragile closure. Then enter Antoine Lavoisier and the oxygen theory of combustion.
The famous Lavoisier.
Right. Lavoisier argues that burning is not the release of a substance called phlogiston, but rather the absorption of a gas from the air called oxygen.
Okay.
This beautifully, elegantly explained the weight gain. The metal got heavier because it was physically combining with oxygen.
Wow.
Oxygen theory successfully absorbed the glaring remainder the phlogiston could not handle.
So standard history says oxygen wins, phlogiston loses, end of story, right?
Not at all. This is where Chang's pluralism really shines. Oxygen theory, being a finite closure itself, generated its own remainder.
Really? Like what?
There were certain properties of metals, certain principles of combustibility and acidity, that the old phlogiston theory actually modeled and explained much better than Lavoisier's early oxygen theory could.
No way.
Yes. Oxygen theory struggled for years to explain why all combustible substances shared similar properties, a phenomenon phlogiston explained easily.
Oh, wow. So neither of them had the full picture. They were both catching different fish in the same ocean using entirely different nets.
Exactly. Both systems generated genuine, operationally coherent knowledge of combustion. Each framework captured aspects of reality that the other completely missed, and each generated specific remainder that the other could address better.
So science didn't just instantly flip a switch from dark to light.
No, there was a long, highly productive period where these two systems existed in tension, forcing each other to iterate.
Dietz places Chang's view of this pluralism within a much broader context in his overall framework. He brings in two other major philosophers to build a complete picture of how science handles this tension.
Right. Nancy Cartwright and Helen Longino.
I want to make sure we cover them because it shows how deep this goes.
Yes. Dietz brilliantly weaves these three thinkers together to form a really comprehensive theory of pluralism.
Let's start with Nancy Cartwright.
Cartwright demonstrated this pluralism at the micro level with what she calls nomological machines.
What exactly is a nomological machine?
Cartwright argues that the laws of physics aren't universal truths that apply everywhere all at once. Instead, scientists build highly constrained artificial environments in the lab. These are the nomological machines where things behave predictably. A laser is a nomological machine. A controlled vacuum chamber is a nomological machine. She argues that individual scientific models only capture tiny, highly contrived pieces of what she calls a dappled world.
A dappled world.
Yes. The world is messy and untamed. Therefore, no single overarching model can cover everything. You fundamentally require a patchwork of different specialized models to navigate reality.
So Cartwright shows that pluralism exists in the physical models themselves. You need different machines for different tasks.
Exactly. Then Dietz brings in Helen Longino to explain the human side. Longino shows the social conditions needed to manage this pluralism. She developed a concept called critical contextual empiricism.
Critical contextual empiricism. That is quite a mouthful.
It sounds dense, but the core idea is highly intuitive. Longino argues that scientific knowledge isn't created by a lone genius in a room. It is created by a social community.
Right.
And if everyone in that community shares the exact same background, the exact same biases, and the exact same assumptions, their collective closure will be very weak.
Because they'll all have the same blind spots.
Precisely. they will all be blind to the exact same remainder.
Ah, so you need diversity of thought not just as a moral good, but as a mechanical necessity for science to function properly.
Exactly. Longino argues that you absolutely need diverse perspectives, different backgrounds, and conflicting viewpoints within a community to poke holes in dominant theories and highlight the remainder.
Wow.
The social community must be structured to allow these different, sometimes conflicting models to interact productively without just destroying each other.
So Cartwright gives us the physical models, Longino gives us the social community structure.
And then Ditz places Hassock Chang as the third pillar. Chang as the crucial element of temporal dynamics.
Temporal dynamics.
He shows how this pluralism plays out over history and time, how closures supersede one another over decades, how the remainder from the 18th century drives the next generation in the 19th century, how the phlogiston closure and the oxygen closure eventually iterate, combine, and push chemistry into entirely new paradigms over centuries.
Let me try one final analogy to tie all of this pluralism together.
Go for it.
It's like looking at a complex city, say London or New York. If you want to understand the city, you might look at a topographical map, which shows you the hills, the rivers, the elevation changes.
Okay.
Then you might look at a subway map, which just shows you straight, brightly colored lines and dots for stations. They look completely different. They visually contradict each other.
They do.
If you lay the subway map over the topo map, the lines don't match the physical streets at all, but you don't look at them and declare one true and one false.
Because they possess entirely different operational coherences.
Exactly. The subway map is operationally coherent for navigating the train system underground. It works perfectly for that specific task.
Right.
The topographical map is operationally coherent for planning a hiking route or studying drainage. They are capturing entirely different aspects of the city. They are capturing different remainder.
Yes.
And the city itself, the inexhaustible ground of the city, is vastly more complex than either map could ever be on its own.
Which is why scientific pluralism is not a surrender to relativism.
Yeah.
It is not saying all maps are equally true, so nothing matters. Let's just guess.
Right. It's not giving up.
No. It is a rigorous, demanding acknowledgement that because reality is inexhaustible, we desperately need multiple closures. We need the productive tension between different systems of practice to illuminate the remainder that any single system is inherently blind to.
I find this entire framework so incredibly liberating.
It really is.
Because it takes the pressure off. We don't have to choose one ultimate perfect truth. We don't have to fight to the death to prove that our map is the only map that exists and everyone else is an idiot.
Right.
We just have to keep iterating. We just have to keep building better tools, paying very close attention to exactly how they break, and using those specific breaking points to build the next slightly better tool.
That is the essence of epistemic iteration. It is the fundamental grammar of how finite beings interact with an infinite universe.
So let's do a final distillation of this deep dive into Dietz's grammar of iteration and Hassock Chang's philosophy. Okay. The foundation of our knowledge, whether it's the thermometer sitting in your bathroom, the standard model of quantum physics, or your own personal worldview about how your life works, is never indubitable.
Never.
It is never absolutely universally certain. It's always provisional. It is always a little bit broken.
But that brokenness is not a failure of science. It is not a reason to despair or to fall into radical skepticism and think nothing is real.
Right.
It is simply the mechanics of progress. Mm-hmm. We progress not by finding flawless starting points, but through the specific informative pressure of what we cannot yet understand.
Yeah.
The remainder is not our enemy. The remainder is our guide.
So for you listening right now, taking this highly theoretical philosophy and applying it to your daily life.
Yeah, bring it home.
The next time you feel paralyzed because you don't have all the facts before starting a new project, or the next time your current understanding of a deeply held topic is challenged and you feel that hot defensive instinct rising up in your chest, remember the thermometer.
Remember the thermometer.
Remember that you do not need an Archimedean point to begin. You don't need a view from outside the universe. Start exactly where you stand. Embrace your imperfect tools and your provisional guesses.
Right.
And when you make mistakes, when your models break down, when you encounter that uncomfortable remainder, don't hide it. Don't build a wall to defend against it. Let those exact specific flaws guide your next iteration.
Treat reality as a partner you continually learn from, rather than a fixed structure you are failing to perfectly mimic.
Beautifully said. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative thought to chew on.
Oh, let's hear.
Something that falls right out of the logic of everything we just discussed, but completely turns our normal desires on their head.
Okay.
If every scientific closure, every human worldview, every mental model inevitably generates remainder, and if it is precisely this remainder, these flaws, these anomalies, these painful breaking points that actually drives all scientific progress and human learning,
yes,
then achieving absolute certainty wouldn't just be impossible. It would actually be the death of knowledge.
Wow.
Think about it. If we ever somehow managed to build a perfect system, a flawless closure with zero remainder, all inquiry would instantly stop.
Because there'd be nothing left.
Exactly. There would be no pressure to improve, no mysteries to investigate, nothing left to discover. The engine of human progress would freeze solid.
That is a wild thought.
Which makes you wonder, is our deep, exhausting human obsession with finding final absolute answers actually a hidden desire to just stop having to learn?